Money rarely announces itself as a weapon. It shows up as help, a bill paid, a roof kept over your head, a favor that feels necessary. In many Caribbean homes and diaspora families, money is survival. It always has been. That truth makes it dangerous. Control does not start with threats, it starts with access. Who holds the cash? Who decides what is necessary? Who gets told to wait? Over time, choice narrows. Questions feel ungrateful. Silence feels safer. The balance shifts, quietly, steadily. We tell ourselves, this is responsibility. This is love. This is how families work. But when money decides where you can go, who you can speak to, or whether you can leave, something has already gone wrong. This episode is about financial abuse. Not as a private failure, but as a cultural blind spot, a form of control so normalized that many never name it until they are already trapped. This is our history, too. And once you see it, you cannot unsee it. Chapter 1, Setup and Stakes. Money entered Caribbean life as survival long before it became leverage. After slavery, freedom arrived without land, without wages that could sustain families, and without protection. People survived by pooling resources. One person worked, another cooked, another watched children. Cash passed hand to hand. Trust filled the gaps that systems refused to cover. That structure kept families alive. It also planted the seed for control. When survival depends on one income or one gatekeeper, power concentrates. Not because someone plans it, but because necessity allows it. Whoever controls the money controls time, movement, and decision-making. At first, this feels practical. Someone has to manage the little there is. Someone has to decide what gets paid and what waits. In many households, that role hardens quietly. Informal economies shaped daily life across the Caribbean and followed people into migration. Cash jobs, seasonal work, remittances sent back home. Money rarely moved through banks, it moved through people. That meant rules were unwritten. Authority was personal, accountability was social, not legal. If you needed money, you asked. If you asked too often, you were judged. If you questioned decisions, you were reminded who provided. Gratitude came a currency. Silence became payment. This is where financial abuse hides best. In these systems, money is rarely called money. It is called help, support, sacrifice, a favor. Those words matter because they shape behavior. You do not argue with help. You do not demand transparency from sacrifice. You do not refuse a favor when your children depend on it. Control does not begin with restriction. It begins with framing. A partner insists on handling the bills because they are better with numbers. A parent keeps wages safe so they are not wasted. A relative manages remittances to make sure money reaches the right people. These explanations sound reasonable. Often they are true at first. But control reveals itself not in what is given, but in what is withheld. Access becomes conditional. You must explain your spending. You must ask before buying necessities. You must justify time away from home. Slowly, money stops being shared and starts being granted. In many Caribbean cultures, duty is sacred. Children owe parents. Partners owe loyalty. Elders deserve obedience. These values are not abusive on their own. They become dangerous when paired with economic dependence. When money enters the room, duty stops being mutual. A person who depends financially is taught early to minimize needs. Do not ask too much. Do not embarrass the provider. Do not bring shame. Over time, this training reshapes identity. Wanting feels selfish. Independence feels disloyal. Leaving feels like betrayal. This is not accidental. It is reinforced. Community plays a role. Questions about money are treated as disrespect. Outsiders are warned not to interfere. Family matters stay inside the house. If someone complains, they are told to be grateful. Others have it worse. At least you are not hungry. At least you are not on the street. Survival language shuts down resistance. The Caribbean legacy of scarcity intensifies this dynamic. When history teaches you that resources can disappear overnight, control feels like protection. Hoarding feels responsible. Restricting feels wise. The line between care and coercion blurs. Migration adds pressure. In diaspora households, money often carries the weight of multiple lives. One paycheck supports relatives back home. One job sponsors papers. One bank account decides who stays and who goes. That power is enormous. In these settings, financial abuse does not look dramatic. It looks orderly. Budgets are tight. Rules are strict. The provider is stressed. Everyone is told to understand. Meanwhile, the dependent person loses autonomy piece by piece. They stop working because childcare costs too much. They stop saving because they are told it is unnecessary. They stop dreaming because dreams require money. Eventually, they stop imagining a life outside the system. The warning signs are subtle and often praised. You are told you do not need to work. You are told your role is at home. You are told the money is safer with one person. You are told to trust. When you hesitate, you are reminded of everything that has been done for you. Guilt becomes the lock. Financial abuse thrives where gratitude is demanded and independence is punished. It thrives where love is measured by sacrifice and silence. It thrives where leaving means losing not just money, but community, identity, and belonging. This is why many people do not recognize it. They are not beaten, they are not screamed at, they are provided for. From the outside, their lives look stable. Inside, their choices shrink. Control over money often comes with control over information. Bank statements are hidden, debts are undisclosed. Income is exaggerated or minimized depending on what serves control. The dependent person is kept uncertain, always guessing, always cautious. Uncertainty breeds compliance. This dynamic crosses gender, but it is not evenly distributed. Women, elders, migrants, and undocumented family members carry the highest risk. Those already conditioned to defer are the easiest to trap. Those taught that survival requires obedience are the least likely to resist. None of this requires cruelty to function. It only requires imbalance. And imbalance is inherited. Post-slavery Caribbean societies learned to survive without safety nets. Families became systems. Those systems rewarded control because control reduced risk. Over generations, that logic hardened into norms. What began as protection became possession. By the time someone realizes what is happening, the stakes are high. They have no savings, no credit, no independent income, often no legal standing. Leaving does not just mean walking away from a relationship. It means stepping into uncertainty with nothing. That fear is not imagined, it is real. This is the pressure point where financial abuse becomes invisible. The system works because escape is expensive. The longer it lasts, the higher the cost. Each year without access compounds dependency. Each sacrifice narrows options. And the most dangerous part is this. Many people inside these dynamics still feel loved. They still feel loyalty. They still defend the person controlling them because that person also kept them alive. This is not a simple story of villains and victims. It is a story of power shaped by history, scarcity, and silence. But survival should never require surrendering choice. What looks like help at first often becomes a leash, and by the time it tightens, escape already costs too much. Chapter 2: Escalation and Reversal. Financial abuse becomes unmistakable when patterns replace excuses. What once felt like organization turns into enforcement. The rules stop being flexible. The reasons stop changing. Control settles in. The tactics are rarely loud. They are administrative. Who signs for benefits? Who holds the debit card? Who knows the passwords? Who decides what counts as an emergency? Each decision narrows the dependent person's options without ever announcing itself as punishment. Wages are the first pressure point. A partner insists on collecting paychecks to manage expenses. Overtime disappears into household costs that cannot be questioned. Tips, bonuses, and side income are minimized or absorbed. The dependent person is told there is nothing left, even when there is. Benefits follow. Health coverage becomes leverage. Miss an appointment and you are accused of wasting money. Ask about therapy and you are told it is unnecessary. Medication refills are delayed. Illness becomes expensive. Dependence deepens. Bank access is often removed quietly. Accounts are merged for convenience. Statements stop arriving. Online access is controlled by one device. Questions about balances are met with irritation. You are told you worry too much. You are told to trust. Debt is another tool. Loans are taken out in shared names without explanation. Credit cards are opened and maxed. Bills are paid late, on purpose, to damage credit. When the dependent person objects, they are reminded they did not earn the money anyway. Debt creates paralysis. Poor credit blocks escape. Remittances complicate everything. Money sent back home carries expectation and authority. The person who sends decides who deserves help. The person who receives is reminded constantly of sacrifice. Gratitude becomes mandatory. Resistance becomes betrayal. Migration status sharpens control further. Sponsorship is power. Paperwork becomes leverage. Threats do not have to be explicit. A raised eyebrow is enough. Silence carries meaning. Deportation is never said out loud, but it is always present. Gender roles enforce compliance. A woman is told her place is at home. A man is told his worth is provision. Either way, deviation is punished economically. Work is discouraged. Education is delayed. Opportunity is framed as unnecessary risk. Shame is the enforcement mechanism that keeps the system quiet. People are taught not to air family business. Financial conflict is framed as disrespect. If someone speaks up, they are labeled ungrateful or difficult. Community pressure seals the trap. Even friends hesitate to intervene. They see provision and assume stability. They see a roof and assume safety. Without bruises, concern feels inappropriate. Inside the home, the rules tighten. Spending must be justified. Receipts are demanded. Small purchases are scrutinized. Time becomes money. Leaving the house requires explanation because transport costs something. Social isolation follows naturally. Isolation is not always intentional. It is efficient. When a dependent person starts to realize what is happening, confusion sets in. The control does not match the affection. The provider still says they love you. They still sacrifice. They still remind you of everything they have done. This creates cognitive conflict. If this is abuse, why does it feel normal? If this is control, why does it come wrapped in care? That confusion delays action. Fear fills the gap. Fear of homelessness, fear of losing children, fear of disappointing family back home, fear of starting over with nothing. Each fear is practical, not dramatic. This is where financial abuse differs from other forms of harm. The danger is structural, it is slow, it is cumulative, and it is reinforced daily by logistics. Even moments of awareness feel dangerous. Looking up information risks being seen, asking questions risks retaliation. Planning feels impossible without money. Some try to work secretly. They hide cash, they save coins, they sell small items. When discovered, the punishment is swift. Accusations of deceit, tightened restrictions, increased surveillance. Trust is weaponized. You are told secrecy proves you cannot be trusted. Control increases under the justification of protection. Children become anchors. Expenses are blamed on them. Threats of custody appear. A dependent parent is reminded they cannot provide alone. The idea of leaving feels irresponsible. Elders face similar traps. Pensions are controlled. Property documents disappear. Decisions are made without consent. Dependence is framed as care. Obedience is expected. Across all ages, the same rule applies. Whoever controls the money controls the timeline. They decide when things happen, when repairs are made, when help arrives, when relief is granted. Time pressure exhausts resistance. Community institutions often miss it. Financial abuse does not fit easily into reporting systems. There are no visible injuries. There are no police calls. There is just compliance. This invisibility benefits the abuser. It also isolates the victim further. At this stage, leaving is no longer a moral decision. It is an economic calculation. Where will you go? How will you eat? Who will help you? What will you lose? The answers are rarely reassuring. Many stay not because they believe the control is right, but because the alternative feels worse. Stability, even controlled, feels safer than uncertainty, especially for those raised in scarcity. This is the reversal point. Awareness arrives, but instead of liberation, it brings weight. Seeing the system does not break it. It reveals the cost of escape. Financial abuse relies on this moment, the realization that freedom is expensive. The moment awareness arrives, the cost of leaving becomes clearer than the cost of staying. Chapter 3, Consequences and Legacy. Financial abuse does not end when control loosens. It lingers. It reshapes how a person sees themselves long after access is restored or a relationship ends. Money becomes charged. Every purchase carries doubt. Every decision feels risky. People who lived under financial control often describe the same aftermath. A constant fear of scarcity even when resources are available. Guilt when spending on basic needs. Anxiety when checking balances. Independence feels unfamiliar, sometimes frightening. This is not weakness, it is conditioning. Years of being told what was necessary and what was waste rewires judgment. Choice was removed so often that choice itself becomes overwhelming. Freedom arrives without instructions. Identity suffers quietly. Many people stop trusting their instincts. They defer automatically. They apologize for needing. They measure worth by usefulness rather than dignity. Financial abuse teaches people to shrink. That lesson does not disappear easily. The impact on mental health is deep, but often unrecognized. Depression hides behind gratitude. Anxiety hides behind responsibility. Shame blocks language. People struggle to explain what happened because there was no single incident, just years of narrowing space. Children absorb these dynamics even when they are not the direct targets. They watch who asks and who decides. They learn who holds power. They learn what silence looks like. Money becomes emotional long before it becomes practical. Some children grow up repeating the pattern, others reject it entirely. Both responses carry scars. Elders face their own legacy. When pensions, property, or savings were controlled by others, reclaiming autonomy feels impossible. Dependence becomes normalized. Fear of abandonment silences protest. What is framed as care can erase consent. Extended families feel the ripple effects. Resentment grows quietly. Trust fractures. Remittances become sources of tension. Obligation replaces connection. Financial abuse rarely stays contained to one relationship. It spreads through networks. Community complicity plays a role. Silence protects reputation. Interference is discouraged. People are told not to wash dirty laundry in public. This value, meant to protect dignity, often protects harm. Institutions struggle to respond. Financial abuse does not always fit legal definitions. It leaves paper trails, but not always proof of intent. Systems built to respond to crisis miss slow violence. Policy gaps matter. Access to emergency funds, independent banking, and legal protection determines whether escape is possible. Where these supports are weak, control thrives. In Caribbean and diaspora contexts, this gap is wider. Informal economies leave fewer records. Migration status complicates reporting. Cultural expectations discourage disclosure. The result is under recognition and under response. Naming the abuse matters. Language creates clarity. When people learn that control over money can be abuse, confusion lifts. Patterns become visible. Shame loosens its grip. But naming alone is not enough. Recognition does not immediately restore resources. It does not erase debt. It does not rebuild credit. It does not repair trust. The work is long and uneven. Many who leave financial control face backlash. They are accused of ingratitude, of betrayal, of breaking the family. Community pressure intensifies. Support may be conditional or withdrawn. Freedom has social costs. Some rebuild slowly. They learn to budget without fear. They open accounts in their own names. They make small decisions and sit with the discomfort. Independence becomes a practice, not a moment. Others struggle for years. Poverty follows them. Stability feels fragile. Trauma resurfaces during financial stress. Without support, the cycle threatens to repeat. This is where history matters. Financial abuse is not just personal. It reflects systems that denied generations economic autonomy, slavery, indenture, colonial extraction. These histories taught control as survival. Breaking the pattern requires more than individual courage. It requires community reckoning. We must question norms that equate provision with ownership. We must challenge ideas that gratitude cancels consent. We must recognize that care without choice is not care. This does not mean rejecting family, it means redefining responsibility. Support should empower, not confine. Sacrifice should not erase autonomy. Our history shows us what happens when power goes unchecked. Financial abuse is a small-scale version of a larger truth. Control thrives where accountability is absent. Listening matters, believing matters, offering practical support matters. So does patience. Recovery is not linear. Independence is learned. The legacy of financial abuse is not inevitable. It can be interrupted, but only if we are willing to see it, name it, and respond without judgment. Money should never decide who gets to leave, who gets to speak, or who gets to choose. Even after control ends, the damage keeps collecting interest long after the account is closed.